give us one funny thing that being the head coach of an associate team, well, that would never happen to an India or a South African national team or one of the test playing nations.
We've run out of ball several times. I can tell you that. When you only have a certain amount of balls that you get in your budget, and then you get the call, then you call in to say, please, can I have 12 more?
Yeah.
And they say there are no more.
Yeah.
Welcome to The Biggest Man in Cricket with your host, David Brooke.
We are back at our home venue. We are back at Bootleg in Cape Quarter here, and we finally complete the set of cooks, the trilogy of cooks. We are proud to welcome Ryan Cook here today. Cookie, thanks for coming in. I know you're just fresh off a World Cup venture, and we'll get to that. But welcome home. Welcome to Cape Town. How are you keeping?
Yeah, very well. Thanks, Brookie. Thanks for having me. The trilogy of cooks, as you say, when you sent your message to me to say, would you join and complete the set, as it were. So, no, thanks very much for having me.
It's been is it weird being home for, I mean, Cape Town is home, right?
Yeah, most of the year. Well, I've got a house here, put it that way. I don't spend a lot of time in that house. But obviously, SA20, you're on the road a lot, plus the Netherlands fixtures through the year. And then you've got the IPL as well. So a lot of time on the road. But yeah, I've been very fortunate. My family's followed me around a lot in the last little while. So I've been able to keep up with them as well. But yeah, a lot of travel, but great to be home.
So you are just let's get the Cook bloodline sorted, yeah. You are the youngest brother to Stephen, so the two brothers, and Jimmy Cook is your legendary father.
That's the one.
How, I mean, we spoke to Stephen about it. I mean, he was obviously you guys grew up watching your dad play in and obviously in South Africa, but also overseas. How was that for you?
I was quite young, when my dad was going through the system. I don't really recall a whole heap of the stuff other than obviously going overseas and spending half the year there and half the year in the UK and half the year in South Africa. And then obviously as my dad retired, obviously my brother was kind of coming through the sort of the ranks as an under 13 and going on from there and making some strides in his cricket. And I was just enjoying the game along the way. It was a time where you could be in the change rooms with the players. So, in and amongst the jock straps and the pads of these types of players. And I don't know what that did for me, but it obviously being around that environment helps a lot. And that's probably made me into a coach who kind of understands the game, understands change rooms. Probably my mom has the unsung role in this whole thing. She was an organizational psychologist, did a lot of individual self-training and things like that. So caught a lot of the culture piece from her, caught a lot of the sort of general improvement in myself and in others. She sort of makes up the whole piece of the puzzle, but definitely being around cricket and cricket in the blood for sure.
Which are the players from back in that day growing up, would you watch? I mean, you obviously were forced to watch your father play, but which other players did you enjoy watching back then?
Yeah, I think my dad always used to laugh because he used to say I used to appeal when it hit him on the pads because I wanted him to come back into the change room so we could play, So, I didn't enjoy watching him as much as I probably should have and can't remember that clearly exactly how he played. And lots of people say, gee, your dad was amazing. And I don't really remember too much of that. All I can remember is him being in his pads, throwing us balls after the day's play in, Taunton or whatever it might be. He's 150 not out at the end of the day's play. The last thing he wants to do is probably play with me and Stephen. But he came out there and obviously threw us balls and played with us on the outfield. So that was really cool. One that did stick out to me was Nick Pothos, actually. I remember him having this big trigger movement that I wanted to replicate, and this big back and across and this big movement. And I always wanted to try and bat like other people. So I was imitating him all the time. Neil McKenzie, when my dad was sort of coaching there, that's when I was probably my most impressionable 11, 12, 13 years old, as you can imagine. And so those are the guys that kind of stick out for me.
You obviously, I mean, you're the Cook legacy. Stephen obviously played professional for many years, but you obviously played when you were younger, but you never went into professional playing. Correct.
Yeah, I enjoyed my playing all the way through. I got into a very good year in the high school that I went to. I went to Cairns, and yeah, there were just tons of good cricketers. I think probably in my matric year, we probably had about 9 players who went on to go and play first-class cricket. Wow. So we really had a strong team. And I remember playing against Uffies in my grade 11 year, and they had another 8 or 9 players in their team, you know, the ABs and Arnos and these types of guys, the Fuff. And yeah, it was amazing to sort of play with those guys, but I never played a big role in those teams, more so a sort of a team component, you know, bowl a couple of overs here, wrap up a tail with my sliders and googlies, and then, you know, maybe knock off the winning runs at 6 or 7 if I could. But those guys, Vaughan van der Asfalt, Dane Villas, Blake Snyman, they were all sort of top end players, and our bowling attack sort of were similar, you know. So it was great to play a role in that team, and we were very proud of what we achieved there. And probably then never really kicked on my cricket from there, and took a liking to coaching really early on, straight after school, and never really looked back from there. Still played Premier League cricket all the way sort of through until my 30s. But then, you know, sort of hung the boots up, as they say. But yeah, never really played at a top level at all.
Did you find that you were thinking about the game differently to maybe a Dane Villas or one of the guys?
No, not that I can recall. I think the thing that it was different about me was I was always wanting others to do really well. And I would much rather have won and done poorly than myself done well and the team lose. I can remember that being a massive driver for me. I hated losing. I was very competitive in the backyard with my brother, but, you know, just a very competitive person nonetheless.
He did actually throw you under the bus when we chatted to him and said that when it was the Cook Games night, that you were the most competitive and you would throw the pieces if you lost. So you're at least validating what he said. So it's
true. I think I've grown to mature in that space, but yeah, it was probably pent up aggression because he used to make me bowl for 2 hours, and he batted for the whole time from 4 till 6 until, you know, the bath water had run, and then he'd just sort of ceremoniously chip one to the imaginary cover and say, "You can bat," and then mom would say, "Oh, you guys are going to come inside." So that's why I became more of a bowler than a batsman, probably. So that I can remember, you know, just sort of trying to compete as much as I could. Probably limited skill, but trying to understand the game really well. That was mostly what stood out, not so much the analytical part of the game at all.
Do you find sometimes that, and we'll get into your whole coaching career where it is currently now, but something that I've always been interested in is that obviously there's players that finish there, they have great international careers, they get into coaching almost by default because they maybe were a leader in the team. Do you sometimes feel that if you haven't played professional cricket or international cricket, that there's more focus on the coaching side of things rather than relying on a reputation as maybe a top international player? Do you feel that those players miss out the grassroots of the weeds in coaching?
I think, firstly, I don't think you can replace what those guys have experienced, you know, facing those bowlers at 150 k's an hour, you know, being under pressure to perform, the big crowds and performing in those spaces. You know, you can never replicate that if you haven't done it. You can ask questions and be curious around it and have empathy about how they must have been, which I think obviously becomes a skill set of the coach. But yeah, I mean, I grew up coaching, starting with 6-year-olds and 7-year-olds and sort of trying to understand technique and how to teach and how to coach, and did that for a long period of time through one-on-ones and obviously some team coaching and things like that. So I've sort of had a bit more of a journey along that way. But my advice to you, a lot of players who want to get into coaching, is I say try and go down a couple of levels and try and coach down at a school or go and coach down at a club, because getting your stuff across to those types of players is actually ultimately what counts. And yes, your experiences can count for a lot, but at the end of the day, you know, it's what they get and the message that they receive at the end of the day. So I think there are pros and cons to both. I certainly would love to have had some of those experiences that they speak about, and I've been very fortunate to be able to rub shoulders with guys who have played at the highest level and done amazingly well, and also, you know, the coach's coach who's not been able to play at the highest level, but yet has come through the system and is an amazing coach in their own right. So I think it can be done either way, and neither should be seen as an advantage or not. But I think it's what your players are in front of you and how best you serve those guys.
Doesn't seem to have hampered you. So has it hampered you that you've, you know, has there been an owner of one of these franchises that go, no, he's never played, he's not a big name, he hasn't played international cricket for 10 years, like, who is this guy?
You'd have to ask them that, I suppose. But no, I think your work can speak for itself, and that's sort of how I've seen it. I think all the players that you come in contact with, or the coaches that you come in contact with, can see the work that you're doing and can see if there's quality there. So that's kind of the philosophy that I've always taken. I'm sure it obviously does help to have a name, you know, even just in recruiting myself with, you know, with the Netherlands and things like that. We do look into, you know, what was the past history of this player. That definitely becomes part of the equation, but we know that that's not the be all and end all of it all. So I think if we can keep upskilling ourselves, whether we're a player that didn't play at the highest level or we were, I think the coaching skill is kind of what comes into it. And I remember running a coach education session with Andy Flower, who said, you know, that credibility that you have as a player probably lasts about a week. Yeah. And then everyone wants to know, how's that going to affect me, you know? Yeah. So that's always interesting to note that those kind of guys, and Gary Kirsten was one of my mentors, who often said, you know, your runs that you scored in your career don't count for much once you're in that position as a coach.
Gary's obviously been quite an important figure in your career. Just take me through that journey, how it started with him, and obviously it's taken you to some lofty places around the world, but where did it all start from a coaching point of view for you?
Yeah, so I was coaching Johannesburg at the time. I was doing some stuff with South Africa under 19 and stuff with Kez at my old school, and some stuff with my dad at his academy. And I was looking for opportunities to sort of see where I could grow. And our captain at the time of the Kez team was the captain of the under 19 team who were going to India. And I thought, oh, it'd be great if I could connect Gary and him so he could kind of learn some tactics. Anyway, I tracked down Gary's number and I just sent him a message to say, like, this is the situation. I've got this captain. Wouldn't you mind just jotting down a couple of points for him? Here's my email address. And he ended up sending me, I think, like 3 or 4 pages worth of information on the different venues they were going to go to. And I was like taken aback that this guy was, you know, so open in sharing all this information. And who was I? So the next time I was down in Cape Town, I said, oh, I'd love to meet up for a coffee. And that's kind of how it all started. Ryan van Niekerk and him had started a his own cricket academy.
Yeah.
So we sort of started growing that academy together. And I moved down here. And then, yeah, just our relationship took off. We went to the Hobart Hurricanes together. We've obviously started a couple of businesses together. And it's just been a great kind of mentor relationship. And I'd like to feel that sometimes he gets some value from me, but I've definitely extracted a whole lot of value from him.
I think he can be very proud of where you've gone in your coaching career. Something that's really, I find really interesting is the Coach Ed, the program that you started with Gary. Just take us through what that is. And why you created that in the first place, because something like that was never around when you started your coaching. You obviously had to go through the normal level 1, level 2, coaching.
I was very fortunate. I got to actually move through the system of coaching quite quickly. You know, I had my level 3 by 22, I think, which was kind of unheard of at the time. So I was very fortunate to get through that and getting into those different environments where I was working with under-19s and the South African Academy and the Gauteng teams in those days. And then, in 2015, we sat down in Gary's Academy and said, if we were to grow the Academy, we'd want the coaches to be able to have a certain amount of knowledge and a certain way of coaching that they'd be able to run it wherever they are in the world. And then they said, well, if you're passionate about the project, why don't you start it and go from there? So it was a long journey. It took us about 5 years to collate all the information, you know, how we were going to put it across, what was going to happen. And then we finally got it to a point where we could actually take it online. We tried a couple of workshops. And as COVID hit, we took it online. We were extremely amateur at that stage, but we'd built so much great content, obviously through Gary and others, to be able to push this out there. And that Coach Ed course has just grown and grown. We've got like a lot of alumni now that have come through it that are sort of at the top of the game. at the World Cups. You're often obviously meeting up with all of them and stuff like that. And it's just great to watch coaches going through their journey. And generally, there has been a bit of friction around the levels and around how coaches get sort of further qualification and how they go up the ranks.
Yeah.
And this is an avenue that is, you know, hopefully going to help coaches get through that without the red tape that sometimes, you know, certain countries sort of bring into that.
Does it get recognized by ICC and by Cricket South Africa as a qualification?
A lot of the time we've engaged with them in, with, you know, will you send this accreditation or will you put your stamp of approval on it? And I think it's sort of gaining a bit more traction that it's a very credible piece of work and that it definitely adds value to the coaches that are doing it. I don't think it's necessarily in their best interest to be able to say this one is better than our one or this one is seen as similar to ours. So I don't think that will change, but we try and coach a very neutral way. I mean, Australia might, you know, put their coaches towards a certain way of coaching or South Africa towards a certain way of coaching. England, they have a certain way. But ours is pretty neutral in terms of what that is. And I think people enjoy that. It's like an international flavor. The guests that we've got on and the people who are teaching the content are coaches from around the world, some of the best coaches in the world. So I think that is where we get, you know, a lot of traction from that.
A lot more practical rather than just theory, etc. Is it geared towards only South Africans, or are people from around the world that can register? And
yeah, anyone from anywhere can do it. And we've had people from all over the place. I think there's 67 countries that have been represented so far. Wow. So it's really quite a global community, and we've been sort of driving that community piece quite a lot. And it's great to be part of that, because you want coaches to kind of move forward as a coach. You want players to move forward. You also want to move forward as a coach.
And then take me through your kind of your first foray into international cricket. It was with Bangladesh.
Yeah.
How did that come about?
I think it was probably through Gary Kirsten as well. They had approached him and said, would he want to try and take on the white ball team? He said, probably not, but there's a couple of guys that he could sort of help them with to be able to get their white ball team to a certain place. Steve Rhodes came on as the coach, and I remember Steve phoning me and saying, do you really think that you can be a white ball fielding coach only? So I said to him, well, this is kind of what I've been tasked to do.
Yeah.
And he said, I don't think that you can. I think you should consider doing this thing full time and coming on for the full team, the Red Bull, the T20 and the Wonders. So that was the journey with him, with Steve Rhodes. And it was a great journey. You know, we had a great coaching staff there.
Steve Rhodes, the former England wicketkeeper.
Yeah.
Okay, wow.
And he was a great head coach. We had some really good people around us. Neil McKenzie was part of that. Courtney Walsh was the bowling coach. And we really got along well as a group. It was fascinating, eye-opening for me, in terms of going into those environments. I remember after the second day thinking you might have to forget everything that you've learned, because what you know is not necessarily what you're going to have to deliver here. So, but it was great. I mean, I was there for 3.5 years and I learned so much and gained some great relationships with those guys, and just sort of started to understand international cricket a bit better. So that was really helpful for me.
I've heard like countries like Bangladesh, Afghanistan, etc., that Pakistan, the players are not as receptive to coaches as maybe it's a local coach, etc. How receptive were those particular players?
Interesting. I probably had the other end of it. I felt I went in there and straight away had credibility in their eyes. I felt that they thought that we were on a certain track and that me coming in was going to really help them, whether that was because the fielding wasn't that good at that particular time. But I definitely got a lot of buy-in very early, and it was almost for me to lose the credibility rather than for me to gain the credibility. So that put me on the front foot straight away. And I like to think we'd implemented quite a few things. Steve Rhodes was really passionate about his fielding, so he was sort of pushing that side of things. And yeah, on the whole, I think we actually did do some really good things along the way there, and managed to beat some big teams. Probably didn't quite get to the fruition that we wanted to by the end of it. But we had a great time there, and obviously I feel like we moved a lot of the players and the team forward.
I've heard it's quite challenging being in that coaching set up in Bangladesh. Like, you never know when after a game you could get the boot. Is it that volatile, or is it, do you feel secure? Do you ever feel secure in a job like that?
I was probably shepherded from a lot of that stuff, and the head coach probably takes on a lot more of that than maybe the fielding coach does. So we sort of stayed under the radar, maybe potentially a bit more. I'm not sure who you speak to in that regard. Maybe I think in those types of environments, it's quite emotional, and winning and losing does make a difference day in and day out. And understanding that there's maybe a bigger cause to what we're trying to achieve here is not as long as you would get normally with maybe another team. So they want to see results, and they want to see that there's progression all the time. And obviously the fandom is amazing there, any of those subcontinental countries. Yeah. So I think from that perspective, there's always a bit of additional pressure to keep getting those results and see that's going forward. I never really felt that too much. It sort of came to a good amicable end on my side. I was coming to an end of a journey there in 2021, and obviously left on very good terms with them. So it was a really good relationship that I built with them.
How I always believe that at that international level, the skill level is there, but certain things like fitness is often the difference between becoming a superstar, world-beating teams, and just being part of the international arena. Is that a fair statement?
Can be. I think in a lot of the countries where they're multi-sport athletes, where they've kind of grown up in this way of playing and the system looks after them to a certain point, it's very hard to not be physically in good condition or be able to do things with your body physically. In Bangladesh, sometimes that's not the case. The guy's maybe played cricket his whole life. That's all he's done. He hasn't picked up a tennis racket or thrown a rugby ball or kicked a soccer ball. So that's what they are trained to do. So that becomes quite unique. I think, obviously physical has become a big part of things in terms of the power game in T20 cricket, running between the wickets, bowling fast. And one of the things I actually really enjoyed about Bangladesh was that every player that came in was on such a different level of information. And we used to talk about, they talk in the gym about training age, so we would say, like, this guy's fielding age is only 5 years old, even though he's been playing cricket for, international cricket for a couple of years. We had a guy who won like a $1 million arm kind of idea, and they went to find the fastest bowler that they could find. And I would end up with practice, just lobbing him tennis balls underhand type of thing, because that's where he was. Yeah. And you wouldn't necessarily be doing that in the South African environment per se. So I think, again, it's where you're starting where the player is, starting where your team is, and what do they need at that particular time, and then being able to rank it up to what is required of them, if it is a World Cup that's coming up, where does everybody need to be at? And that's obviously the physical component as well.
What is the second and third level like in Bangladesh cricket? Because we see international cricket, it's relatively strong. But what's that underneath levels like there?
There's a huge amount of talent there. Mm. All the players that come through the system and into the team generally actually do quite well. Mm. So there's a great amount of players playing there. They put quite a lot of emphasis into the academy system and the under-19 system. I mean, obviously they won the World Cup a couple of years back now. They try and develop that as much as they can in terms of coming through. I think underneath that, though, sitting into the kind of divisions and things like that, probably the quality of the cricket or the wickets or that kind of stuff is probably not quite there. That's pushing guys into, like, they can play international cricket easily. But definitely through the structures and A-side tours and things like that, you do find that guys do come into those teams quite ready, and there's a huge amount of talent there. If they can nurture what they've got going there, that's going to be really special for them.
I'm going to ask you a similar question when we get to the Netherlands side of things. But tell me how that came about. You obviously got the job in the interim basis. First up, the head coach at the time was sick. I think he had a heart attack or something like that. And you got the job on an interim basis. Just take us through that start of that journey.
it was kind of fortuitous in some ways, but Ryan Campbell was the coach of the Netherlands, and I got a phone call just after Easter that he'd had a heart attack. They were having their biggest summer of cricket coming up. They were playing in the World Super League and had three international teams coming to play one day internationals, and New Zealand coming to play T20s as well, plus the qualifiers. So they had probably the biggest bump of summer that they've ever had, and they needed a coach. I had done quite a bit of work with the Netherlands with Gary Aries Academy. So, you know, that they knew of me and I was available because I just finished with Bangladesh. So, yeah, well, kind of said to my wife, listen, I've got this phone call, you know, what do you think? And I said, I'm going to need your support, though, because this could be quite a hectic time. Mm. And, yeah, I mean, just from the start, it was fantastic. You know, I enjoyed the players. I enjoyed sort of what they were bringing to the table. I wasn't aware of some of the challenges that associate cricketers face. You hear about it, but until you're down at the rock face, you don't really know exactly what it's like.
Yeah.
And, yeah, what a fascinating journey it's been with them. But, yeah, to start off with, that was something that we had to navigate. Ryan was obviously coming back and recovering from that, and the transition between him leaving the coaching and me starting the coaching and then going to the World Cup in 2022 in Australia, we had both of us there, so the team was kind of like with both of us, which was quite actually a nice way in the end for it to finish, and then for me to kind of start up with the team from 23 onwards.
That 2022 World Cup, that's the World Cup where you beat South Africa. That must have been an emotional roller coaster for you and for some of the guys in the team as well. Just take us through that.
Yeah, so we qualified for the sort of 12, the Super 12s or whatever it might be, yeah. Which was different from how the World Cups are now. There was like a pre-qualifying tournament, and that was, you know, a really good effort for us nonetheless. So, we qualified for that. We ran Bangladesh really close, actually, in the one game. We played against India, which was a great thing for the guys. And then we went to Adelaide and played really well against Zimbabwe. And we had sort of South Africa maybe 2 or 3 days later in Adelaide again. And we weren't actually sure of the repercussions of if we won or if we didn't win. We just kind of treated it like we were preparing for another game.
Mm-hmm.
But subsequently, obviously, Rudolph taking that catch and, you know, like obviously the rest that follows that game, I think we played a really good game of cricket. And obviously South Africa might not have been quite up to where they needed to be on the day. But, we really played well. And all the stuff that we've been working at and preparing on, like, kind of came together that day. And that actually pushed us into the top eight, which qualified for the 2024 World Cup automatically, which was massive for Netherlands cricket. So I think that was, we only found that out way afterwards, once the other results had gone our way. So we actually didn't know at the time that is what we'd achieved, but we had put ourselves in the position to do that. So that was really satisfying for the guys. And obviously any time that an associate nation can beat a full member nation, never mind South Africa, is a great thing for them. So I think that was a great moment and one that everyone will cherish who was part of it.
Did you have your mates messaging you, like you celebrating this massive win, but you're also South African, so you got your mates messaging you, what the hell have you done? And you celebrating. That must have been weird.
Well, I think it was such an early game that I don't think many South Africans were actually awake at that time to watch it. And I think it was probably a fait accompli that, you know, South Africa were going to win and go through to the next round. And then as it turns out, you know, South Africa don't go to the next round. So, I think those messages started coming through like, geez, like, what is happening here? You know, maybe it's some kind of April Fool's joke, you know, but... It was obviously bittersweet in some ways because you grow up kind of like watching all these guys and working with some of them as well. And then obviously I was fully committed in around the Dutch team and what they were trying to do. So it was very sweet from that point of view. You know, as I say, a lot of the plans that we put in place kind of came to fruition, and that's always nice for a coach to see.
Just take me through what goes on a day before a game like that. You're not favourites to win by any means. And you're always, as a coach, you're always going to prepare your team as best you can and you're always going to back your team. But the reality is 9.9 times out of 10, you're not going to beat those sides. What do you actually, what goes on from a mindset point of view to you as a coach saying to your players beforehand?
I think a lot of the work has been done prior to that point. You know, we run like a lot of theming. We run a lot of like... like kind of scenario things that we want to try and do and ways that we want to play and the style in which we want to do. So most of the focus is really on yourself. You've got specific plans for certain players, much like everybody else does. And then it's just executing it on the day that you're kind of speaking into a lot of the time. So I think it's no different from what normal preparation would look like. You don't up the ante because it's a certain team that you're playing or a lesser team or something like that. You prepare exactly the same. You do your thing and they do theirs and you see who comes out on the day. And I think those gaps are closing now. I think with associate cricket, you know, and full members, that gap is closing. And with more exposure, I think the associate teams will start taking a lot more victories in those fixtures.
Has T20 cricket brought that gap closer? I mean, do you find that associate nations can compete against the test playing nations in T20 cricket more than you can in a 50 over World Cup, for example?
I don't think it's really been tested since that Super League. We didn't win a lot of those games. So yeah, potentially you could say that we wouldn't really win too many of the 50 over games. But to qualify for the World Cup in 23, we had to, you know, beat the West Indies. We'd have to go past a couple of full member nations along the way. So I think we don't really know that, to be honest. We're involved in the Cricket World League 2, which is the 8 associate nations, and that's super competitive. You know, you're playing day in and day out. You win and lose is a big thing.
40 games over a 2-year period or something crazy to qualify for the qualification stage of the World Cup.
Yeah.
Whereas the test playing nations, they just need to be in the top 8, etc., to actually get in. I mean, that's a lot of cricket.
Yeah, you play a lot of cricket. You play in a lot of different conditions. You play against a lot of players who sometimes you don't know that well. So it's really challenging, a very competitive league. It's something that sometimes other countries wouldn't necessarily have seen. So, you know, when you go and play Oman, it's very challenging. It's not like you're rocking up on flat wickets and you can kind of go skill for skill. So I think from that perspective, it's very challenging and prepares you well for that. But T20 cricket obviously does bring it closer. The only thing, you know, that stands in the stead of the full members continuing is that they're getting a lot more exposure in the leagues.
Mm.
So the amount of games played per year for a T20 player, whether they're playing international cricket or not, from a South Africa or an England or an Australia, is way more than, you know, an associate country would play. Because there's no ICC T20 league other than the qualification. What teams tend to do is when you go on a tour to go and play again a trial series against Oman and Namibia, for example, you'll tag on some T20 matches just because the flights are kind of paid for to get there.
Yeah, yeah.
More than it is we actually need this. So
yeah.
We won that game in 2022. The next time we played a T20 game against a full member was against South Africa in 2024. Jeez. So you're only playing 6 games between that time in that qualification tournament. So. And then most of our players in the Netherlands, for example, are not part of any of the leagues, really. They might get the odd outlier here and there. So, you know, your whole year, you may be playing 6 international T20s and you may be playing a couple within the club system in the Netherlands, but you're not getting a whole lot of exposure in that space. Whereas a player who's maybe playing in the RPL and in the PSL and in the Caribbean League and in the SA20, they may be getting 80, 90 matches a year, which definitely does make a difference.
But I mean, you know, the associate nations, like we've seen Zimbabwe now in this World Cup, they now qualify for the next World Cup. They've made it through to the Super 8s. How does that gap actually get closer if you're not playing? I remember it was during the start of COVID where Netherlands were playing in South Africa, that one day series, which was curtailed. But how do you improve if you don't? And I don't know what the solution is. And I'm sure it's a debate every time associate nations get together with the ICC. But how do we improve the associate teams?
I think firstly, I mean, Zimbabwe do leave a template for everyone. Mm. You know, they are not an associate nation. They're a test playing nation who's played an unbelievable fixture list over the last 2 years in all formats.
Mm.
You know, they've been to England for test series. South Africa have gone there to play test series. They've had one day competitions against pretty much everyone in the world. They've traveled to the subcontinent. They've played T20 fixtures there. So they've had pretty much a full run in of what that's like. And you'd like to feel like there's an immersion into that full member space where you sort of start to play at that speed. You start to understand the positions that you're in and that you believe that you can actually win games because you have won games. Unfortunately, that doesn't happen really with the associate teams. As I say, you don't really have the chance to get that. So you might have seen in this World Cup where a couple of guys, teams are in a position where they can make a play, but end up sort of falling away towards the end. So I think from that perspective, I think there has to be a little bit more done in that space. And that will come with teams recognizing finances are tight. It's very hard for the Netherlands to, with the budgets that they have, host extra matches, for example. So we would need to be invited, much like Bangladesh did with us in August, to come and play and fit a lot of the bill of us going over to play there. And more teams probably need to do that in order to play more full member games and then get the exposure that I think the players probably rightfully deserve.
give us one funny thing that being the head coach of an associate team, well, that would never happen to an India or a South Africa national team or one of the test playing nations.
We've run out of ball several times. I can tell you that. You know, when you only have a certain amount of balls that you get in your budget, and then you get the call, then you call in to say, please can I have 12 more?
Yeah.
And they say there are no more.
Yeah.
So we ended up practicing in India with SG balls, which were, you know, the Indian ball,
yeah,
which have no kind of replication really to the Kookaburra turf. But yet we are practicing with these balls and playing with different balls in the tournament. So that was, that just kind of goes to show you where things are. But yeah, I mean, it's there's so many different things that the associates face that maybe the full members don't do. But it's always challenging. But I must say that the guys take it in their stride. There isn't, you know, there's no complaining into that space. Yes, obviously the players would like to be remunerated better. Yes, they'd like a fuller fixture list, and all those things are rightful. But I think the there's so many different little things that happen in the associate cricket that you'd think, wow, geez, I can't believe that that's taken place.
What I mean, so there's obviously been a number of South African by birth that are playing for Netherlands. I've always wanted to know, do countries like the Netherlands actively go and look for those players? Or is it like a player goes, my mother's got a Dutch passport. Maybe, you know, I'm not going to qualify for South Africa, but maybe there's a chance for me to play for the Netherlands. What's the process there?
As far as I've been involved, we've never actively gone out seeking anyone that has a Dutch passport from any country or a nationality that can link them back. But I think with the fact that we've done really well and people kind of track their lineage, and is this a chance for guys to do this? Definitely, you know. So we've been fortunate in a couple of ways where guys do come over, they qualify to come and play for us, or they have Dutch passports already. And they obviously add massive value to our squads and our depth in terms of what we've got. And I think that's been probably the biggest thing from coaching in the last 3 years, just the players that we're bringing through the system, the ones we started to leave out of the teams, who are all quality international cricketers in their own accord, and they sort of fighting for their places now, because we've been able to build a lot of depth, and that's not just through getting passport holders, but getting a lot of cricketers coming through the system who are aspiring to the next level and want to be out there at World Cups, and, you know, the under 19 guys coming through the system and the club cricketers sort of pushing on a little bit more. So that's been really good to see.
What's the levels like in Dutch cricket? Do they play it in school? Is there a strong club system there?
There's no school cricket at all.
Really?
It's just club cricket.
Wow.
And that, when I first arrived, was pretty much the only feeder to international cricket.
Yeah.
I remember in the first sort of selection meeting that we had, the guy said, oh, this guy got 40 on the weekend, so let's pick him, you know. And I said, guys, like, I actually went down to watch the game.
Yeah.
It's on a full AstroTurf.
Yeah.
He was facing some very mediocre bowling, and I don't think that really resembles Alzari Joseph, who we're about to play next week. So that was a little bit different. And now we sort of put a couple of structures in between club cricket and the international games to be able to be very confident that a guy could come in and perform on his debut and win a man of the match type of thing. So that's been really good. But club cricket is very competitive there. There's 8 teams in what they call the top cluster, and they're very proud. The community in Dutch cricket is extremely intimate and very passionate about what they're doing and the sport, but it's very small, you know. They're more hockey astroturfs than players, playing cricket in the Netherlands. So it is a small sport in comparison. Mm. And we try and do the best we can to obviously keep the high performance stuff running, but also the club stuff running as much as possible.
Do you get support from the government at all?
I think there is some funding that comes in from the government, but again, very small. Mm. I mean, most of the revenue will come in from the ICC through the qualification scorecards.
Yeah.
And then obviously you would have seen, you know, the plight for sponsorship for Associate Nations.
You basically double up as the sponsorship manager as well. I remember that press conference that you put it out there that we're open for business, which I love, because, I mean, you would never get Sourav Ganguly or Gautam Gambhir going in a press conference there calling out partners. But That's what you're going to do, which I thought was great.
Yeah, well, I got wrapped on the knuckles for that. But we don't have a commercial manager or a sponsorship manager at that time. We've now onboarded one now. Yeah. But I think that's where the game's going. You need to be able to commercialize your game. And yeah, we don't have that in the Netherlands. So calling out for sponsors to be able to just come and bring in that kind of shortfall of the programs that you're trying to do and then be able to execute on those. It does need funding. And unfortunately, the RCC scorecard doesn't necessarily give you the amount to do. And that's just the reality of the teams who have the aspiration to do more. They do need a little bit more budget to be able to do that.
Well, you're on the biggest man in cricket now, so you're going to get a Kookaburra looking to sponsor your balls now when this episode goes live.
Oh, please, yeah, come and cook it to us for us. It'll be great.
But listen, I mean, recently, I love the story from this World Cup now, where it came out that you were the first coach, or you were the only team that people had heard about who were asking for, normally you ask for net bowlers. You called on a net batter because you wanted to bowl, you wanted your bowlers to bowl to lefties. Just take us through that crazy story.
Oh, well, I think it seems publicized, but we've been doing it the whole tour. And even in the pre-camp as well, we had picked a team with only exclusively right-handed batsmen. Our bowlers needed to learn how to bowl to left-handers. Obviously some of the teams have more left-handers than others. So everywhere we went, we would request a net batsman, and the left-handed net batsman would come and face. The funny part comes in where sometimes the net bowler is bowling at the net batsman, and I'm saying, hey, that's not what you here to do. So I think the bowlers were sort of forthcoming with that, and I must take my hats off to them. They were very proactive to say, if we are going to be successful against left-handers, which we are going to need to be at this World Cup, we are going to need to obviously do this and make sure that this is in place. So we did it pretty much at every venue that we went to. The guys that we got were great. They went and faced an international bowling lineup for the first part of the net, and shared a little bit of net time with Michael Levitt and Max O'Dowd, whoever it may be. And then they sort of batted the whole session. So 2 hours later, the guy would walk away. So it was good. It was a really cool thing to do. And that's the kind of stuff that we sort of pride ourselves on, you know, leaving no stone unturned. And then, you know, the nice story is that at the end, you know, you end up bowling well to left-handers and it looks pretty good. But, we did need some practice in that regard.
There was a first-class cricketer in India that you pulled from a match or from his nets or something like that. Like, is that correct?
Yeah, well, this is the one that's publicized. But, he was just having a net down the road, maybe like half an hour away.
Yeah.
And we put in a request when we arrived to say, can we please have a left-handed net batsman? Everyone probably thought we were joking. And then, this guy got the call, said, please be there at 6 o'clock for their training session. And this guy rocked up and we shepherded him into the nets and away he goes, you know.
What batsman is going to turn down 2 hours on the nets? Nobody's coming to replace you.
No, exactly. And we said to him at the end, oh, what's your vibe, you know? And he said, no, he's the four-day captain of the Gujarat team, and he hasn't actually broken through in T20 cricket, which was like quite amazing because this guy was a pretty handy cricketer.
Probably got 150 first class matches to his name or something.
No, he's a very good player, and that was really cool. Yeah.
That's a great story. But what impresses me most about that is your preparation, and that, you know, you're coming up against India at home in India, and you're going, okay, well, that's going to be a tough one to win, but your preparation is still world class, which I think is testament to that. And obviously, that kind of preparation has seen you coach some in franchise cricket around the world, and in particular the IPL. How did that come about? You with Lucknow Super Giants. Tell us the journey there.
Yeah, I was with the Sunrisers for the first three seasons of SA20 and for the last three seasons of IPL. So just recently moved over to Durban Super Giants and Lucknow Super Giants now. So I think I was approached to do the SA20 and the IPL for Sunrisers, which is a great journey for me. Got to lift the trophy once or twice for SA20, which was great. But most importantly, get to rub shoulders with some great coaches and some excellent players along the way. And the same for the IPL, you know, obviously incredible players, great experience for me there. And obviously look fondly upon my time there. But new challenge now with Durban and Lucknow to kind of give them a movement forward in this in sort of winning a trophy for the Super Giants franchise. So really, you know, looking forward to that.
How's it juggling that? You're obviously a head coach for the international side, but franchise cricket, obviously, nobody, you're going to earn money in franchise cricket compared to maybe associate. How difficult is that how difficult is that to be the head coach of a side and then be the fielding coach or the assistant coach in another team, in a franchise team?
I think to answer that one first, it's I don't really have any issue with, you know, what my title is as the coach. You know, whatever I'm required to do in that particular environment, I'll do. As a head coach, obviously, it's a lot more all-encompassing when you're kind of doing your specific roles, and it's a little bit less so like that. But you try and contribute to the team wherever you can as an all-rounder. And that's something that we've tried to pride ourselves on with the Netherlands as well. We're trying to get as many coaches to come in when I'm not there, and the coaches have done a great job when I'm not there to be able to step in for me, and I've had a lot of support from the KNCB to be able to go and do that. So I think they see that me coaching in those leagues is bringing back great expertise to them, and I'm improving as a coach, and so vice versa, I can obviously give back to the Netherlands cricket and probably from the other side as well. You know, coaching at the World Cups and things like that does put me in good stead for the franchises, and you get to kind of know the players and what the modern trends of the game are. So they work hand in hand, but I'm very fortunate that, you know, both sides sort of see that and I'm able to kind of do both roles.
With the franchise cricket, you obviously don't get a lot of time to actually train. You don't get a pre-season, really. So how difficult is it to have an impact in such a short space of time?
I think it is a challenge, especially, you know, when you're kind of coming in quite late into that environment, as you say, and there are camps and stuff that run now, and, you know, you keep tabs with your players throughout the year, so you keep sort of upskilling along the way. But definitely, you sort of want to try and make as much of an impact as you can. But, you know, reality is you don't get a whole lot of training time. You're going from match to match and traveling around. So, as you all well know, it's just difficult to be able to make too much of a huge impact. But just those small impacts that you can make and those little things adding up over time is something really big. And I've seen that with a lot of coaches in front of my eyes. You know, I think of the RPL with Eric Simons and what good job he does with the bowlers, you know, at Chennai Super Kings, for example. And I've seen what Andy Birrell was able to achieve with the Sunrisers, Eastern Cape, and in such a short period of time, you can upskill players in such a way that they can sort of almost go beyond what they think they can achieve.
We're definitely going to get Andy Birrell on the show at some point. So, Andy, if you're listening, we're coming for you. But something which I really loved about your time at Sunrisers was, you had your fielding award, Eddie the Eagle or something like that, that you awarded a player each time, whether win or lose. Just take us through the thinking there.
Yeah, well, I mean, not to give away too many of the trade secrets there, but basically the philosophy was around energy, execution, and effort. And Andy Birrell added another one, E for attitude. And so in the second season, I thought I better find a fielding award that resembles something, you know, with the E. So I went with Eddie the Eagle. I found a dog toy at the back of a Boardwalk Hotel there, and Eddie Eagle was born, and he stands for those four values. So sometimes it's not down to a fielder, maybe it's something that someone did in practice, and it became more of a cultural award, and it was very coveted. You know, people really wanted to win that award, probably more so than even the Rise of the Day, which is normally given to one of the better performers. The guys really wanted that fielding that Eddie the Eagle award, and that's the beautiful thing about what Eddie Brawl has brought to the Sunrisers, is an incredible culture where those types of things are rewarded, and they're put front and center. You know, there's not many people that speak after the game, and I was fortunate to be one of them, and he's obviously one of them. So it kind of shows how important he feels fielding is, and how important culture is, and I think that kind of comes through. So Eddie the Eagle is continued past me, which is great, and it's always nice to see him getting given out to a guy who takes a great catch or a good diving save.
Amazing. I mean, obviously the IPL is coming up. Your team, like, what are you looking forward to the most with your new team?
Yeah, I think any environment, new coaches, I love learning from new coaches. And some of the guys were here in the SA20, a really great group of guys. So really looking forward to working with Tom Moody as the director of cricket, and Carl Crow and Barrett Aaron. They've been really impressive. I've been super impressed with how they coach. And then Justin Lang, I'll be working with him for the first time as the head coach. I do know him well, but I've never worked with him. So that's going to be fantastic. And then obviously new players, you know, some of the guys you I know, like Aiden and those types of guys, but yeah, some of those guys are all new players, and building relationships with them will be really fun, and looking forward to my time there.
We're seeing more of this kind of global franchises. Tom Moody was obviously in South Africa, director of cricket of Durban Super Giants. Are there opportunities around the world, as you know, is that the future for coaches, where you work for a holding franchise?
I think it's the way it's going. It might even be going that way for players in some cases as well.
Yeah.
I think, you know, it would be remiss for teams not to have a style of play that they want to try and do. And obviously coaches play a big role in the style of that, how you recruit your players as to what kind of style you want to play, which obviously can be a different in different environments in terms of what's effective. In SA20 might not necessarily be effective in the RPL, but you know, to be able to bring that flavor through, I think is really important. So yeah, I think that most of the RPL franchises are attached to a lot of the leagues around the world, and I'm sure that, you know, players and all coaches will keep following those things around, which I think will be good for the continuity of what it means to be a super giant, or what it means to be a Sunriser. And I think that identity and people getting behind that identity is really important.
So you coach around the world, but and in different roles. But what is Ryan Cook's blueprint that you take to all your various jobs around the world?
Well, my coaching philosophy has always been like the co-achieve, which is, you know, it happens to be the first five letters, C-O-A-C-H. So I think when the players are achieving, you are achieving as a coach. So anything where the players can be getting better and I can be getting better at the same time, that's, I hope the players all feel that, you know, I'll give the best of myself, and I expect the players to give the best of themselves back. So I just really want to achieve whatever that player wants to achieve, or whatever that team wants to achieve, and play some role and part in doing that. So yeah, probably some would say a lot of energy and a lot of intensity. But yeah, probably a little more acumen and stuff I get along the way as I've got older as a coach, and being able to sort of strategize around and what things work. I'm passionate about culture and how much that can do for environments, and I really feel there's a competitive edge there. So that's something that I always try and push into the environments that I'm in. But I'm pretty much an all-rounder in that way, and I can help you in any way, you know, whether it's battle ball or in the field, or, you know, maybe even if it's something strategic or something in just a good relationship.
Cookie, we are coming to the end of our chat. It's flown by. It's really been such an interesting chat, and a completely different angle from what we've had on the show. So thank you for that. We do have a section called The Declaration, where I throw a couple of quickfire questions to you. Just answer them as honestly and as you feel. Okay. You're going into battle, whether it's, I don't want to mention war, but you're going into battle. Who do you take first? Rudolf van der Merwe or Jimmy Cook?
Rudolf van der Merwe.
Well, okay. Your greatest coaching moment to date. I think I know the answer to this, but I want to hear it from you.
Probably Dara Masala against South Africa in the 2023 World Cup. Again, another one of those days where all the stars aligned in terms of what we planned and how we executed that day. Yeah, that's probably my coaching highlight.
That was the 50 over World Cup, yeah.
Yeah.
The one crazy plan, like out-of-the-box plan, which was discussed in a team meeting, which came good in the match, and you couldn't quite believe it.
Well, we had a thing which I always laugh about watching now, which in the 2022 World Cup, we tried to field what we called uncomfortably close. So however close you think you should be standing 1 or 2 meters closer than that.
Yeah.
And I remember... Aiden Markram actually getting out, sort of trying to play a shot through mid-wicket, and Stefan Myburgh taking a catch at extra cover in that game. And as he got caught, I thought, what the hell is he doing there? He was standing in what can only be described as silly extra cover. And I don't know why he was there. He felt that's the place for him to stand. Maybe it was he was slightly old and he was worried about them running a one to him or something. But yeah, we all stood very uncomfortably close. And when I watched back the videos of that, I remember thinking to myself, geez, the guys, that was actually too close. You needed to probably take a step back. So that was something we prided ourselves on. We trained a lot of it, and it came to fruition in the match where that kind of came good for us.
That's very cool. The best coach you've ever worked under?
Eddie Brill.
Player to watch out for in Dutch cricket that's coming through that may be just on the cusp of international cricket that we should look out for?
Zach Lyon-Cachet. He's a very good cricketer. He's a young guy, extremely competitive. He's got athletics in his bones. He was a soccer player for Southampton for a while when he was a young guy, and then he turned into cricket. And his mom actually played tennis at Wimbledon. So he's got a lot of raw materials that we really like. So he plays the game in the way that we like guys to play, and I feel he's got a really bright future.
Very cool. Not the brother of Keegan.
Cousin, I think.
Cousin, okay. Yeah. I mean, how many Lyon Cachets are there in the world?
That's what I said.
And then the final question, Cookie. What does Dutch cricket look like in 5 years' time?
I think it will probably depend quite a lot on the ICC funding, to be honest. You know, the funding model is a certain way at the moment. We make best with what we can within that model. I think if it's shifted and it becomes a little bit more favourable towards the associate nations, then Dutch cricket can really grow. At the moment, it's sort of at a place where it's at the level that it's at, and we try and obviously outperform the system, as it were, and try and do it as well as we can possibly do it with the limited resources that we have. So a lot will probably depend on how much funding can come into the game. I think the players are super committed. I think the people that work there are super committed. So it will just really depend on how much you can do so that you can bolster the system. And with that, we'll flow on extra performance. So the group of players we have now in the men's game in particular is very exciting. They're all kind of coming to maturity now, and we've got a couple of nice young players coming through, and the women have just qualified for the first time in the World Cup, so that's really exciting for us. So hopefully that can drive some aspiration through the women's game. I hold a lot of hope for Netherlands cricket, whether I'm not there or not there, that we've set up some structures that will be able to be sustainable over time. But as I say, you know, you can only take it as far as you can take it, and the reality is that that's not very far. Yeah.
Tell me, just looking ahead, we've got the IPL coming up. We can't not just talk about that briefly. I see you guys have launched your new kit, etc., which looks very football-like, actually, which is quite refreshing. It's something different. You've obviously got some exciting senior players there, but who maybe have you've looked at your squad, maybe a youngster that you've heard of but looking forward to working with?
There's a couple of guys I actually have worked with before, but not as much. There's a guy, Abdul Samad, who I worked with at the Sunrisers, who's now there, and a young bowler called Akash Singh, who we rated very highly at the Sunrisers, who's also there now. One I'm really looking forward to working with is Ayush Badoni. I always hear really good things of him whenever we play against him. You know, you always keep an eye on him. So I'm really looking forward to working with him. I think that'll be something to look for this season.
You get to enjoy a little bit of Cape Town. So we're at our old friend's Bootlegger. So I've got a little bit of coffee. I don't know if you're going to finish this by the time you go to the IPL, but you can leave it with your wife to have while you slave away in the IPL. Ryan, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the show. And I've really enjoyed the chat about something completely different to what we've had on the show. And I wish you everything of the best with the IPL coming up and Netherlands cricket, and maybe see you win more international matches, more IPLs, and hopefully when you're back from the IPL and you win the title, we can have a coffee.
Sounds
thanks so
good.
Much for coming on the show.
Thanks very much. Cheers, that was great. Thank you.